KVSHLP Vashon, your island connection, streaming online at voiceofvashon.org.
Welcome to Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo. In Human Music, we dive into the mysteries of music composition and performance in its cultural and historical context to gain a deeper understanding of the creative process. This week's guest is Gary Cannon, Artistic Director of Vashon Island Chorale, Emerald Ensemble, and Cascadian Chorale. Dr. Gary Cannon is a conductor, musicologist, and singer. In 2016, he founded the Emerald Ensemble, a professional chamber choir engaging the region's leading ensemble singers. Since 2008, he has served as conductor and artistic director of two prominent community choirs. The Cascadian Chorale, a chamber choir based in the east side suburb of Bellevue, performs a breadth of mostly unaccompanied repertoire, including many premieres of works by local composers. The Vashon Island Chorale, numbering 80 to 100 singers, is a focal point of our island's arts community. At the invitation of Early Music Seattle, he founded and directed a Renaissance choir, Sine Nomine. He has conducted for Vashon Opera, Anna's Bay Chamber Choir, Chorale Arts Northwest, Earth Day Singers, Kirkland Choral Society, Northwest Mahler Festival, Seattle Praetorius Singers, and the University of Washington. Cannon lectures for Seattle Symphony and has provided written program notes for choirs across the country. His research and writing topics span music of nine centuries. He taught at Whatcom Community College, where he received the Faculty Excellence Award. As a tenor, he has appeared as a soloist with Pacific Northwest Ballet, Seattle Philharmonic, and the Auburn Eastside Rainier and Sammamish Symphony Orchestras, as well as Bird Ensemble, Chorale Arts Northwest, Master Chorus East Side, St. James Cathedral, Cantorei, Seattle Bach Choir, and Tudor Choir. A California native, Cannon holds degrees from the University of California at Davis and the University of Washington. Vashon Island Chorale will be presenting Water Night at the Vashon Center for the Arts tonight, April 15th at 7:30 p.m., and tomorrow, April 16th at 3 p.m. Today's show, we will be discussing Nicolas Gombert's Lugebat David Absalon. We will start by playing the piece, then speaking to Gary about Gombert and Lugebat David Absalon. At the end of the show, we will listen to the piece in its entirety. I hope that by listening to the interview, you will have a different experience of the piece at the end of the show. I had the pleasure of talking with Gary and recording the interview earlier this week. So please stay with me for this hour as we explore this piece with Gary Cannon, Artistic Director of Vashon Island Chorale, who will be directing the chorale tonight at Vashon Center for the Arts.
Oh.
Can you introduce us to Nicolas Gombert?
Sure, happy to, Mira. Gombert was a fascinating character. He was born in the 1490s in the far north of France, kind of on the border of what now is between France and Belgium. And he may have studied with the great master of the time, whose name was Josquin des Prez, but he also may not have. There are, as is often the case for composers and people of any sort in that era, there are things we know, but a vast array of information we don't know. He worked for a whole bunch of different cathedrals there in the north of France. He's best known for working at Tournai, just one of those cathedrals. And he worked for a time. He was overseeing the boy choristers at some, and there was a bit of a scandal there that he may not have treated them as they should be treated, and was actually on a galley ship for some time. But his sentence was commuted at some point. That said, we actually don't even know when he died exactly. There's this range of about 5 years around the year 1560 that that he would have died, and presumably there in the north of France. Other than some specifics of where he worked at particular times, that's essentially what we know of his life.
Paint the picture of Gombert composing music. What tools does he have?
Oh, wow. What a fascinating question. He would have been sitting at a table or desk, presumably, writing with a quill or some other kind of implement and dipping it into the ink bottle each time he needed to. He'd be very careful not to make mistakes, because if he did, it would be very expensive. Paper at the time was incredibly expensive. In fact, interestingly, at that time when he was writing scores, you didn't write it like we now see it, with everything on top of everything else. So every simultaneity would appear at the same time in the score as if one column. He would have written just one part only from the whole piece, and that would be on about one sheet of paper. And then he'd write to the next one. After that, he would have already composed it entirely in his head, but he could only write out one page at a time in each different part. It's a special kind of talent that we just don't have. Nobody has these days.
And how would he have learned how to do this?
Well, as I said, he may have learned from the great composer of the time. At that time, music was taught as one of the seven basic skills that were taught in any school. He would have studied most likely at a cathedral school. Music would have been a standard part of the curriculum, comparable just as we would be studying math today, but they didn't really have advanced mathematics at that time, so they studied music instead. One of the things that they also studied was logic and rhetoric. So as part of those studies, they'd have to memorize long stretches of text and long stretches of music as well. And that's where he would have developed that specific skill of how to think of one long piece of music in two or four or eight parts all at the same time.
And how was he able to listen to what other composers were doing at the time? How would he have been exposed to that?
Oh, that's some fascinating stories there. At that time, this was before publishing, certainly before music publishing, which was later to the game. Manuscripts of one composer would have made their way by traveling musicians from one cathedral to the next across France, in that case. Then the pieces would have been looked through by the person in charge of deciding what would be performed on a given Sunday, or not necessarily only a Sunday at that time, at the cathedrals and the churches. So they'd go through it and they'd perform it. I say perform because I'm not a liturgical musician myself. The cathedrals might not smile upon my saying perform. I don't know. But they would perform it as part of a church service, and that's how he would get to know the music. Long before recordings, before pianos were invented, so you couldn't just sit down at a piano and play it all. They'd have to hear it as part of the rehearsal and as part of the liturgy itself, the sacred performance.
And who was singing?
At the time, those choirs consisted entirely of men and boys. So you'd have boys singing the soprano parts, and then alto, tenor, and bass would all be sung by men. You'd have about twice as many boys on their parts as you would have men. So it varied a little bit based on how any particular piece was scored, but the high voices were always boys' voices.
And how would you describe his style, his composition style? What was happening stylistically, and what was he doing in particular?
Gombert was right in the thick of a period of major development in music history, in Western music history. Before the era of his presumed teacher, Josquin, music was largely intellectual. There were composers, one of my favorites called Ockeghem. He, for example, wrote a piece of music that could be performed on any one of the modes. So what that means is starting on any pitch, but changing the scale that you would be singing from. Imagine a major scale, minor scale. Well, those are two examples of scales, but at the time they dealt with five others, and that one could be sung on any one of those seven scales. He had pieces like that were kind of intellectual challenges to compose. And with the coming of Josquin, that teacher, he was one of the first people to really start emphasizing the emotional content of the music rather than the intellectual. And Gombert was one of his acolytes. Even if he wasn't his student, he certainly followed Josquin's music and his style. There are many different things, elements that were going on to help ensure that the emotional content was first and foremost the listener's experience.
And why was this shift happening? What was happening historically and culturally at the time?
Oh, culturally, it was an incredibly vibrant time. This is a terrible segue to say, there were a lot of wars. One of the nice things about war at that time, if one can say such a thing, is that it caused people to travel on foot or on horseback from one location to another. So there was a lot of interaction between different communities. This was a time when diplomacy was also increasing, partly because the wars were increasing. They needed to find ways to have peace as well. So you'd have a large number of delegations that would be going from one court to another. And that court, when the king traveled, they would travel with their entire retinue, with their what we would today call the king's household, but at that time included all of the musicians. So if the king went from Paris and to the region of Burgundy or to Tournai, as I mentioned, then he would have taken his whole chapel choir, which could have been 12 or 20 people, along with him. And so there was a great churn and great conversations going on in music. It may seem really, really simplistic to us today, but back then it was a very vibrant time in communications between different parts of Europe.
And why do you think there was a shift happening, composing more emotional from the emotional point of view?
Wow, that makes me think carefully. Humans have emotions, and music is one way to convey that. There has always been a shift back and forth between more intellectual to more emotional composition in Western music. Even today, we're coming out similarly out of a period of hyper-intellectualism into a period of greater emotion in classical music. Who's to say what caused it? I don't know. The Renaissance was just starting, starting in Italy and making its way north. One of the cornerstones of the Renaissance was to really get all of the human experience. That's why all those sculptures have such great details. They really wanted to understand what it was to be human. Maybe the composers were starting to try to tackle what does it mean to be human in an emotional sense as well. That's just conjecture on my part, but it's as good a theory as any, I think.
And what do you think the audience was experiencing? Were they noticing this shift, or did it cause any kind of ripple?
Yeah, the shift would have happened so slowly that they, your typical audience, or in this case, typical congregational listener, since these, this, since I'm talking mostly about church music, they wouldn't have noticed the change because it was happening over the course of decades rather than years. Nowadays, we have a particular artist who might emerge and be a hit for a year or two or 5 years, and then they're gone. Well, back then, things happened much more slowly, again, over the period of decades. So it would have been hard for anybody to notice it. In fact, even the composers themselves, these people like Josquin and Gombert, they probably wouldn't have said, oh, I'm writing in a more emotional style than Ockeghem. They would have been more likely to be thinking they were writing in the same style, but it's only in the course of hundreds of years of hindsight that we can see what was going on underneath.
Hi, I'm Amy Dreyer, Executive Director at the Vashon Island Chamber of Commerce, and you're listening to KVSHLP 101.9 Vashon, your island connection, streaming online at voicevashon.org. All right. Now what should we do?
VOV programming support is provided by Pandora's Box, Vashon Island's provider of quality pet foods at competitive prices. With over 100 years of combined knowledge and experience in pet care and pet nutrition, you'll find Pandora's Box on Vashon Highway, north of the main intersection.
This portion of VOV programming is brought to you by Minglement, Vashon Island's natural marketplace for the conscious consumer, where owners, staff, and customers alike embrace the importance of natural, organic, and non-GMO food and products, along with supplements, tinctures, gifts, bulk teas, spices, and herbs. Find them at Center, where the town of Vashon originated.
This show is called Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo. Today we are speaking with my guest, Gary Cannon, Artistic Director of Vashon Island Chorale. Vashon Island Chorale will be presenting Water Night at the Vashon Center for the Arts tonight, April 15th at 7:30 p.m., and tomorrow, April 16th at 3 p.m. We will now continue our discussion with Gary Cannon about Nicolas Gombert's Lugebat David Absalon.
Oh,
So take us into a Gombert piece.
We were looking at a piece called Lujebat David Absalon, which means David mourned for Absalon. This particular piece is of a genre that's called a motet. Motet, the word, derives from the French mot, le mot, which means word. The idea of a motet originated much earlier than Gombert, by about 200 years, because it involved different words happening simultaneously. So it was a composition based on words, or in French, mot, and then became called motet. Then the term motet eventually came to be used by Gombert's time. It came to be used to identify a sacred piece of music that was outside of a standard liturgical text. The text for that piece, is an ancient one. It's, well, or more accurately, it is an adaptation from Gombert's era of the ancient Old Testament text. King David had sent his son Absalom away and had told someone, whatever you do, make sure Absalom isn't killed. Someone thought that that was an order to kill him instead, and so Absalom was indeed slain. Then the bulk of this text is from David's point of view, crying out things like, woe is me, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee. Oh, my son Absalom. And he says over and over, Absalom, my son, woe is me.
What language are they singing in?
This piece is in Latin.
And who is learning Latin at this time?
At that time, anybody except the poor. The Latin was the language that bound together all of Europe. So if a Spanish court met together with a French court, they would be speaking in Latin. So anybody who had interest or kind of education or training, Latin was one of the cornerstones of the training. In fact, it's quite possible they would have been taught in Latin rather than in the local language.
When I think about composing songs, the words that I'm using, I feel often limited by the English language. There are consonants and vowels that I feel are very clunky when trying to convey something emotionally. Even though the song is in Latin, it still has that emotional power, and knowing what the translation is, it supports that emotional power. There's something in the shape of the words that evokes a spiritual sense.
I agree with you entirely. Especially when you say that English as a language can be kind of clunky at times. As much as I love the English language, it doesn't always lend itself well to music making. One of the beauties of music is that it has the ability to transcend whatever language the piece is in. One can listen to music from Germany or Russia or China or what have you, and still find some wonderful music, even if you have no idea what the text actually means.
And the congregation would have understood the Latin?
There would have been certainly people who knew what was going on in the music. Quite a large part of the congregation would have had no idea. Now, that said, in a piece with as thick a texture, there's that word again, as thick a texture as Lujebat David Absalom, it's hard to make out some of the words anyway. Some words are really clear, like Eume and Fili mi Absalom. But some you probably wouldn't hear at all, and the composer wouldn't have expected you to.
As we're talking, I think of early humans. What they found is a burial site where there were stones in a circle around the burial mound. And that's how we can say that there was a spiritual component to early life, even if there was no record of that spiritual component. And so there's something about being in a cathedral and listening to these sounds, something about the ritual of it that is very emotional. And to think about early humans having these emotions based in a spiritual sense, they're sending their dead somewhere or commemorating their death in some way.
Yeah, I've often wondered how music itself came about, and was it through sacred things like that? The sound of a moan has music to it. Did laments originate with groups of people who moaned together and discovered beautiful sonorities? Any theory is as good as any other, perhaps. I often think, too, as you were talking about people sitting in these cathedrals, you know, nowadays we have huge skyscrapers. Even here in Seattle, we have very, very tall buildings. And when this piece was being sung, the cathedral would have been this gargantuan edifice, so much larger than anything else in the region. And made of stone, just piled atop each other. And these buildings that would take hundreds of years to complete. And sometimes you'd still have church services going on inside a cathedral when the cathedral didn't have a roof on it yet. I think about what it would have meant to those people in the early 1500s to enter an edifice like that and be humbled by it and have a spiritual experience. It's kind of a beautiful thought.
It's not like today where there's a church on every corner, right? It's very location-based. You live in that community, and that is where you go for worship.
Yeah, back then, definitely. And any village might have its own little church, and that was the only church. And in the region we're speaking of in France, it was all Catholic church. There were no other options yet. That was about to happen in the next coming decades, but it hadn't yet.
And so you're standing shoulder to shoulder or sitting shoulder to shoulder with your community members, you know, listening to this mournful composition sung very beautifully and having this kind of communal emotional experience.
Right. And there's the communal emotional experience of hearing it that's also linked to the communal emotional experience of singing it on behalf of the singers. It's possible that this piece would have been sung by only 8 singers. It's also possible it would have been sung by the full choir. I've sung this piece several times, and it's quite a resonant emotional experience to share, especially, you know, in those intense moments or when your part happens to be the part supplying a dissonance against everybody else's. And you can feel that ebb and flow and how different parts take on the dissonance or how different parts take on the main motive, the main melodic idea. It's a shared emotional bond that comes when you sing together pieces like this.
And how do you navigate the tempo of the piece? Where does that come from?
Tempo in Renaissance music is often a complex issue. This music was written about 2 centuries before composers started writing things in the score that would tell you how fast they wanted it. they tended to be words in Italian, like allegro, which would be quickish or on the quick side of things, andante at a steady walking pace, and so forth. With this period, a lot of it comes up to the performers themselves. Sometimes there are pieces of music that in one performance might last, say, 3 minutes, and in another performance would last 4 minutes. And it's how those performers felt the connection should go. This particular piece tends to range between 8 and 8.5 minutes only. So that's not a big range. But the tempo is kind of connected to however the performers feel it at that particular time. Sometimes it's linked also to the human pulse. This music will not have a beat that's really slow or really fast. It'll be kind of connected to what we experience biologically through our pulse. But the pulse doesn't just dictate it, because after all, the pulse can change too. But in that same range is usually when how the music will unfold too.
I tend to listen mostly to live music. I like to go in person and listen to the music in the space with other people and witness the performers also. I don't tend to listen to a lot of recorded music. That's just, I think, my personality. I'm so emotionally driven that I'm always seeking that emotional experience. And it seems like music is one of those safe spaces to have emotions. It makes me think of, like, how do I keep that spirit alive in my music or in my performance? You know, how much of it is composition and how much of it is the experience of performing and the experience of people witnessing and hearing?
Yeah, the idea of recorded music is so new to human experience. You know, the first recordings just scratched away were from the mid-19th century, but wasn't until 1900 plus that recordings were developed to the point where you could hear it and recognize something clearly. I think that the emotional impact of a recording can certainly still be potent, but I agree with you. There's no substitute for the live experience. For most of my live music is the symphony or the opera. Whether the other people are there or not, the performers are there in the room, and there's a kind of palpably invigorating element to that connection of just being in the room together.
I wonder if there is something about that, the temporal element, for example, you know, having, you know, the Dalai Lama and having a communal meditation at the same time, trying to bring healing to the world. And the power of having that meditation happening everywhere at once.
There's also the matter of that meditation transcending time. I've occasionally heard of people who are worshipers at a church, and one of the things they get out of it is knowing that across the world at that point there are people who are engaged in that liturgy. And what's more, that liturgy dates back centuries. And so they're also, in a sense, worshiping simultaneously with vast numbers from the past.
A friend of mine, I was saying, I do love to sight read classical music. I am not a classical musician in terms of performing classical music. I said to him, what's the point of it? You know, I'm not going to be performing this music and nobody's going to hear me perform it. And he said, but you get to live inside the mind of a genius.
Oh, that's a good line.
Isn't that in and of itself of value as an experience.
You are listening to Island Powered Radio on Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington.
This portion of VOV programming comes to you with support from Vashon Center for the Arts. VCA provides quality arts experiences for all ages and creates opportunities for artists to perform and exhibit their work. Find out what's happening at VashonCenterForTheArts.org.
Hi, this is AVA. Whiskey Jim was my imaginary friend until the mix-up with the Velveteen Rabbit made him real. Now he is the host of the Whiskey Hour radio program on Friday nights at 9 p.m. on the Voice of Vashon. I'm really sorry about that. Right now.
VOV programming support is provided by the Recess Lab, Vashon's favorite place to hang out. Literally. The bouldering wall is open with classes, open climb, and shoe rentals. Drop-ins are welcome at the Recess Lab, right behind the KVSH studio in the heart of town. Find them on the web at VashonLab.com.
This show is called Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo. We have been diving into the mysteries of music composition and performance in its cultural and historical context to gain a better understanding of the creative process. Today, we are speaking with my guest, Gary Cannon, Artistic Director of Vashon Island Chorale. Vashon Island Chorale will be presenting Water Night at the Vashon Center for the Arts tonight, April 15th at 7:30 p.m. and tomorrow, April 16th at 3 p.m. We will now continue our discussion with Gary Cannon about composer Nicolas Gombert and his piece Lugebat David Absalon.
When I listen to the piece, it almost sounds like this beautiful cacophony. There's a kind of chaos feeling in there because there is no beat or instrumentation, nothing to really anchor yourself in that you typically think of as musical anchors. But yet it's so structured. Everybody has their role. Everybody has.
What a great perspective that is. I wouldn't have called it chaotic, but in a certain context, you're exactly right that it can. People will have different rhythms at different times or different rhythms at the same time. Moving in different directions. The very fact that all eight voices are voices, that you don't have different timbres of a violin or cello or oboe or drum set functioning at the same time, makes it harder, unless you're used to it, makes it harder to kind of follow along with what's going on in any given instance. So in that sense, chaotic is a really cool term to use for that. Thank you for saying that.
Describe what happened after Gombert's time. How does this piece move through history?
Much of my answer to that would be conjecture, in that I don't know the specific history of this specific piece, but I know basically how the pieces tend to become to be known. This piece first appeared in a published format, that is to say, music printed, in, I want to say, around 1580-something. From there, it would have been distributed through Western Europe. Scores would be purchased at booksellers, I believe, kind of places. Music was treated together with one of the other written words. But scores were relatively rare. At that point, there was still quite a lot of distribution by manuscript. So somebody would see the printed copy, and then they would copy it out by hand. And that would be the source for which a particular church or cathedral would use for performance. Pieces like this then tended to drop out of existence for a few hundred years. After around the year 1600, say, you would not have probably heard this piece of music at all. It would have been deemed an archaic style. And it was around the mid-1800s that scholars started getting a little more interested in the music that was 200 and 300 and 400 years old. And they would discover manuscripts and discover these old publications like the one that Lu Jiebao was first published in. But that was all a scholarly experience. It was all just to have a record of it or so that other composers could study it, not so much for performance. It wasn't really until the early 1900s that larger numbers of Renaissance pieces were performed broadly. There had always been a few that had survived, but just relatively few. I don't know exactly when this piece came back to the repertoire. I would guess no earlier than the 1950s and 1960s. That's when Josquin got to be recognized a little more, and then after him, the people of the generation after him, like Gombert.
Well, in talking about the composition and how it's forgotten and rediscovered, it makes me think of how information is passed down and sort of these myths or spoken stories that are carried generation to generation. And this composition almost feels like that because it's really carried by those who sing it.
Initially, it was by those who studied it, and then it became those who sing it, which is the way that it really lives on, as if it sings. Yeah, in fact, it wasn't really until around the year 1800 that people started composing music thinking that it would last beyond their lifetimes. There were precious few composers before then who would ever expect their music to be sung after their death. Even Bach, who we think of as being kind of ubiquitous in classical music, he was known only by among a small group of scholars until 70 years after his death, when Mendelssohn mounted a major performance of Bach's work and brought him back into the mainstream. If a genius as great as Bach can be lost, then who do the rest of us think we are that we'll remain remembered?
Thank you so much, Gary, for sharing all of your knowledge and insight with us. You learned so much, and I'll definitely bring a lot of this into my own creative process.
Oh, that's wonderful. And that's, you know, the purpose of creative things is if they don't inspire new creations, then they're not serving their full purpose. So it's been a great pleasure chatting with you, Mira. Thank you for inviting me.
You have been listening to Human Music, where we dive into the mysteries of music composition and performance in its cultural and historical context to gain a deeper understanding of the creative process. I've been your host, Mira Jo, speaking with my guest, Gary Cannon, Artistic Director of Vashon Island Chorale, that will be performing Water Night at the Vashon Center for the Arts tonight, 7:30 p.m. and tomorrow at 3 p.m. We have been talking with Gary Cannon about Nicolas Gombert's Lu Jiebao, David, Absalon. We will end the show listening to the piece in its entirety. I hope that after listening to my conversation with Gary, the piece will come alive for you in a different way than when we began the show. Thank you to Jim Marsh for producing this show and his invaluable mentorship. Please join him for the Whiskey Hour radio program every Friday night at 9 p.m. on Voice of Vashon.